I'm excited this morning. I always love starting off a new series, and of course, everybody loves Easter. The story I'm going to be talking about over the next couple of weeks is the prodigal son, and it's found in Luke chapter 15. It's probably one of the most famous stories in the Bible, and I was just looking up just a couple of things on it, and the prodigal son is mentioned in movies like Rocky and Blade Runner. And so I thought to myself, if you're of the generation of Rocky, you would know the story. And I guess for the future generations to come, they'll be talking about it because Blade Runner is kind of a future generation story. Everybody's talking about the prodigal son. Some of you are thinking, where on earth in Blade Runner is prodigal son? Don't worry about it. It's in there. So the story's out there all over. I mean, I think it's amazing that a story Jesus tells 2,000 years ago makes it into movies like that. It just kind of boggles my mind by it. So no matter where you're at, you can identify with it. The other interesting thing about the story is the audience to which the story is originally told to. And it says in Luke chapter 1 and 2 that Jesus had gathering around him both sinners and tax collectors and Pharisees and teachers of the law. And what that is trying to get across is the people who are listening to Jesus tell this story are the worst of the worst people in society and people who were considered to be the best of the best people in society. And so it's kind of a really mixed group here when you think about it, because if you've ever taught a mixed group, you know how hard it is to plan a lesson plan. Think about if you're a teacher and in the same class, you have kids who can barely grasp the basic concepts, and then you have the most gifted kids in the class. That's kind of what he's trying to do. He's trying to teach about God in a way that people who are very, very, very far from God and have really made a mess of their lives can understand. At the same time, trying to teach and communicate to some people who, as far as they're concerned, have got it going on with God. I mean, they have it down with God. And the message he's trying to teach, the message he's trying to get across is, what does God think of me? Right? So we're trying to answer the question, what does God think of me? And you picture for those two groups, they're asking that question from two very different places. I mean, the group that's very far from God and the group that has made a lot of mistakes and really messed up their life and is kind of would consider themselves in the worst of the worst, they're wondering, I wonder what on earth God thinks of me. And they're probably thinking something like, I think God's probably pretty mad at me. I think if I were to pray to God, I don't even know if he would listen. As a matter of fact, I'm just uncomfortable even being in church right now, but it is Easter and I'm supposed to go, so I'm here. I'm just trying to make my mama happy, my wife happy, my friends happy. That's the only reason why I'm here this morning. And I don't really know what God thinks of me. And the roof's probably going to cave in just from me being here. And that actually happened to one of the guys in our church one time. We were doing some renovation project. It was kind of a side story. It wasn't supposed to come up right now. He just got back from deployment, and he gets back, and she's like, I got saved, and I want to go to church. And he's like, oh, whoa, what? She's like, yeah, and they're renovating the church, so come up and help. And so he's like, oh, okay. And he gets up here, and like he just walks in. I'm like, here, can you hold this? And while he's holding it, somebody else cut a wire, and this whole light fixture falls in on his head. And he's like, I always knew the roof would cave in if I showed up here. Because, you know, the question is, what does God think of me right now? On the best of the best side, if you're on that category, you're probably thinking right now, have I done enough so that one day when I walk in before God, I'll hear, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Great is your reward. Have I done enough to make God happy? Have I pleased him? Have I done enough to get to the point where God says, that's it, that's what I'm looking for? And so no matter where you're at on the spectrum, whether you're in the worst of the worst or the best of the best or somewhere in between, there's that nagging question somewhere in the back of your mind is what does God really think of me right now? I mean, I'm a good person, but I've made some mistakes. So what does he really think of me right now? I think it was A.W. Tozer. I always mess up who, I always get those old guys mixed up. I read them, but then I forget who said it. So yeah, my thought is if I forget who said it long enough, eventually it'll be my own quote, right? And one of the great quotes is, one of the most important things about you in your life determines who you are and what you become is what you think about when you think about God. How do you picture God, and who do you think God is, and how do you think God feels about you? And the reason why Jesus came to earth was to help us answer that question. About what is it that God thinks about when he thinks about you, or what does God think of you right now with where you're at? And in this story, I got to tell you, we're going to be unpacking this story over the next couple weeks, and don't take this wrong, but as a pastor, you kind of tend to not like holidays. Because holidays dictate and determine what you have to speak on for that Sunday. Whereas if I were to lay out this series, this message would not come probably until like the last or second to last week of the message. And you're going to be like, wait a minute, why are we picking up right in the middle of the story? Well, Because in the middle of the story is the Easter message of the story. I think I even shared a couple of weeks ago that usually in a lot of biblical stories, what's in the middle is like the most important part. And that happens to be true in this case as well, is that the middle kind of holds the key to everything. And so we're going to pick up in the middle. And then later weeks, we're going to pick up, you know, and we're going to talk about the beginning. We're talking about the end. There's basically a father in the story, and he's got two sons, and both sons have some issues. And so we're going to be talking about all their issues. But right now, we're just going to be looking at the middle of the story. So if you've never... I'm going to assume everybody's at least heard the prodigal son. And all you really need to know is the basics of the prodigal son. And that is, it's a guy who left his father, made a mess of his life, and is trying to figure things out. And for most of us in here, we've been down that road before. And that's why we've all heard of it. That's why we've all thought of it. And every one of us kind of says, yeah, I'm the prodigal son. And so we pick up in the middle of Luke chapter 15. And it says verse 17. It says, when he came to his senses, and this is where he's kind of at rock bottom. And so we're just picking up right there in the middle of this. It's a prodigal son. He's gone down on that road, and he's made a lot of mistakes. And it says, when he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food enough to spare? And here I am starving to death. And so he comes up with a plan. He says, I will set out, and I will go back to my father, and I'll say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So just make me like one of your hired servants. And so let's just kind of unpack on where he is in that moment. And he says, when he came to his senses. And if you've been down that prodigal, I say if you've been down that road, I don't think there's any one of us who haven't been down the prodigal road at some point or another. Some of us are there right now. Some of us kind of keep going down that road. Some of us kind of go down and we veer back. We go down and veer back. Some of us can look at a point in our life, we say, that's when I went down there the worst. And how we get there is always different for everybody. We have different ways of getting there. For some of us, it's just kind of a slow drift and a slow fade. And you just kind of didn't really think about the stuff you were doing and where you were at and the decisions you were making. For some, it's because you quit going to church. Some, it's because you just kind of got disconnected from things. A lot of times, it's just we got too busy in life. And life kind of got in the way of making wise choices. And somewhere along the way, we just got to a point and we woke up one day and we said, how did I get here? You know? Others of us, it was a very deliberate decision. We got really mad. We got ticked off at God and just said, that's it. If this is what it's like to follow you, I'm done. I've been trying hard. And this is what I get for trying to live the kind of life you want me to live. This is all the thanks I get. And this is how my life turns out. It doesn't seem like my life's turning out any better than anybody else's who's making other decisions. So, you know, I'm going to go out and I'm going to be happy for a change because I'm not really happy following after you right now, God. And so whether you got there because of a deliberate rebellious act or whether you just kind of drifted and faded away there, every one of us has found ourselves in that situation one day where we just kind of wake up and we come to our senses. It's that moment where you begin to see clearly, the moment where you begin to think rightly and you go, how on earth would I ever, in my right mind, ever date a guy like that? Been there? Anybody? I haven't been there. I've been at the other side where I said, how did I ever date a girl like that? I've been there. And you see clearly for the first time, and it's like this fog, and all your friends all along keep on saying to you, what do you see in that guy? Why are you with him? And you're like, oh, he's wonderful. And then all of a sudden, one day you wake up and you realize where you're at. Others, you, it's like, you know, how on earth did I ever go into business with somebody like that? Or why did I make that decision? Why did I think that that would pay off in the end? And you find yourself, you've made a horrible financial decision, and you look back and you realize the whole time it was all motivated by greed. It was all motivated by how much I could get and what else I could get. And there was that little voice in the back of your head saying, this isn't a good idea. This isn't a good idea. But you're thinking, but look how quickly this will pay off. And I don't want to do the whole Dave Ramsey plan or the whole steady plotting brings prosperity. The heck with that. I can get paid now and I can make big money now. And everybody else doesn't know what they're talking about. I know what I'm doing right now. And all of a sudden it doesn't work out. And you wake up one day and you go, how on earth did I ever be so stupid? And it's a painful moment when you come to your senses. It's a painful moment, but it's a very, very necessary moment because when you come to your senses and you begin to see exactly where you are, you're finally thinking clearly and the fog lifts. And whenever I talk to couples who were one of them is involved in an affair, oftentimes I'll be talking to the other spouse and I'll just say, you know, until the fog lifts from their eyes, there's nothing we can do but pray. Because when you're in the midst of that fog and you think that this is it and this is what's going to make me happy, there's no getting through. And I can talk till I'm blue in the face and say, what you're doing and what the road you're going down is not going to work out like you think it is. And it's a glorious moment for everybody else when they finally come to their senses. But it's a painful moment for that person, but it's the best moment of their life because they finally begin seeing clearly. And so that's where we pick up in the story, as he finally begins seeing clearly. And he recognizes the wisdom of Proverbs 14:12. It was written by one of the wisest guys who ever lived. The reason why he was so smart is because he went down a lot of bad paths. If you read the book of Ecclesiastes, this guy's like tried every bad path you can imagine. And then he writes a lot of stuff about what he learned. And one of the things he says in Proverbs 14, he says, "There's a way that seems right, but in the end it leads to death." It seemed right at the time, it felt right at the time, but it just messed everything up. And when you're at that point where you come to your senses and you know that you need to get back right with God, there's that question in the back of your mind of, what should I expect when I try to go back home and try to get right with God? And the reason why Jesus came to earth was to answer that question. The reason why God left heaven and he came down and he lived among us and he walked among us was to answer that one question of humanity. What should I expect when I realize and I come to my senses and I realize just what I've done, how far I've blown it, how much I've messed up? What is God going to think of me if I try to come back home? And so, for him, he sits down and he realizes what he's lost. And kind of like that song that we just sung, better is one day in your courts than a thousand elsewhere. That's kind of what he realizes in that moment. He realizes just one day back at home with God. And home is a place where you feel love and you feel secure. And just one day in his presence is better than anything else I've ever experienced out here in the end. And so he sits down and he begins to write out a speech. And you can almost just picture him just pulling out a sheet of paper and starting to write it down. Maybe he pulls out his iPhone and starts finger pecking away on the notes page. And he's trying to think about what is it he's going to say to God. What is it he's going to say to his father when he gets back home? And the first word he writes down is a very powerful one, and I don't want to skip it. He just writes down, "Father." And just by writing that, he's writing down and acknowledging what it is that he misses most and what it is that he's lost the most. And what he's basically saying, just in that one statement, is that the money that I've wasted is immaterial right now. And the innocence that's lost is immaterial. And the decisions I've made is immaterial. And the consequences I'm facing right now doesn't matter nearly as much as what I've lost right now. And that is my relationship with God and understanding that he is my father and I am his son. And that's what I've lost. And I know I'm not worthy of that anymore, but that's what I long for. That relationship between me and him is broken. And earlier when I said the most important thing about you and what determines the course and direction of your life is what you think about when you think about God. And what Jesus came and did and taught about God was so revolutionary, was so out of the ordinary, is that in the context in which he shared it was Romans, where the Roman Empire had pretty much conquered the entire known world. And so they pretty much determined what thought was, what popular opinion was, what popular thought was. And they didn't know what to make of these people who were following after this guy named Jesus. They didn't know what to make for about 200 years after Jesus left. They didn't know what to make of people who were following and had an understanding of God the way Jesus taught it. Because every time Jesus addressed God, he called him Father. Every time but one, that is. Okay. Every time. I mean, so almost every time that Jesus addresses God, every time but one, he always addresses him as Father. And that was so revolutionary. It was so unheard of in the Roman world. They didn't know what to make of these people who were looking to God as a Father. They didn't know what to make of them. They actually called them atheists. They called them they called it an anti-religion. And I think it's funny that nowadays we associate Christianity with religion, but the people who really got it, who listened to the message that Jesus was saying, it was so unlike anything else in anything else that was ever taught about God. Romans looked at this as, what you're teaching has nothing to do with God as we know it. It's an anti-religion. They actually called first century Christians atheists because their idea of God was so foreign to anything else that was taught about God. They said, there's no way you're even talking about God because God isn't like a father. And before you go down a road and say, well, I don't think good think thoughts when I think about Father, just ride with me on this at least long enough to think about this. Whatever you think about your father, can we all agree that like everybody's dad's a little different, right? And there was your dad, and there was your best friend's dad, and there's your boyfriend's dad, and there was your girlfriend's dad, there was like other dad you knew in the neighborhood. And we all know different kinds of dads. And there were good dads, and there was bad dads, and there was dads who were loving and caring, and there's dads who were very hurtful. And so Jesus, just allow Jesus to talk about his father. And know that he's talking about a father unlike any father you've ever dreamed of. He's talking about the kind of father you always longed and wished for. And so just allow him that freedom and liberty, don't allow your definition of father from what you grew up with to define Jesus' definition of father. Allow the definition of father to be defined by how Jesus looks to his heavenly father. And you've seen other good examples of dads, even if you didn't have one. But he says, what you think about when you think about God should be like a heavenly father. A father that's unlike any other. And so as he's sitting there and he comes to his senses, he realizes, that's what I've lost. I've lost the best thing I ever had, and that was my father. And then he says three very powerful words. He says, I have sinned. I have sinned. And what's interesting to note is there's no buts, there's no becauses, there's no reasons, there's no ifs, ands, or buts after that. And that's kind of where we usually go with this. I've sinned, but you know, the reason why I did was because you, or because of my dad, or because of my wife, or because of what she said. And you know, I may have made some bad decisions, but they led me down that road. They sold me a bill of goods, and I just fell for it. I'm kind of a victim here. And when you get to the point where this guy's at, you're done playing the blame game. And you just say, I have sinned. And by the way, that's the voice of my daughter, who I think just saw me on the video screen. And it's going to come back into play later, but I love the fact that when my daughter sees me, she wants to come in here. And you've seen, if you were here at the Christmas service, the last Christmas service we had, that's what happened. I don't know what it is about these special holidays. She always sees me on that video because it's playing on a video monitor right there. And if they ever take the kids in the hallway for anything, she sees it. And on this is going to come back into play later, but on Christmas Eve, she sees me. And she bolts, and they can't catch her. And she runs in here. She jumps up in my arms and interrupts everything I'm doing. I'm like giving the invitation. We're about to have communion. We're about to do a candlelight service, and she runs in. And it's okay. And she can get away with that. And she had a dirty diaper. And we're going to get to that. She's going to play in really well. But it's okay, because when you're a dad, you love the fact that your kids want to be in your arms when they see you. And at this moment, that's what this guy realizes he's lost. And so he just says, I have sinned. Will you say that with me? I have sinned. Say it again. I have sinned. You know, it's one thing to say it in church when we're just kind of repeating it. But it's another thing when you look into the eyes of somebody that you've sinned against and you just say, I've sinned. I don't have anything really else to say. I don't have any excuses. And the reasons why don't really matter. I just need you to know that I know I've sinned. I have messed up. And then he goes on and says, against heaven and against you. And this is a really hard concept for us in a very individualistic, Americanized world to understand this concept, really what he's getting at here. And I'm hoping this morning to maybe somehow communicate to you what it means when he says, I have sinned against heaven and against you. And there's another guy in Scripture who says a very similar thing. It's a guy named David. David was a king. He was actually probably the most famous king in the Old Testament. And early on in his life, he makes some mistakes. That's kind of putting it lightly. Just to give you a little history, just before you think that everybody in the Bible is perfect, you'll realize if you actually read the Bible, you'll find people in the Bible are more jacked up than you've ever been. All right, it's very comforting to read the Bible if you actually read it, okay? There's this point in David's life where he goes out on his roof, and he looks over, and he kind of peers into this other lady's house, and he sees her naked. And he kind of likes what he sees. So he does some digging, finds out she's married, but doesn't really care. He's got the fog kind of over his eyes. He hasn't come to his senses. He's just kind of living in that dream world. And he calls her up, and he invites her over. And they end up sleeping together, and then he realizes, oh, stink, that's right, she is married. And so he does what any of you would do. He kills her husband. And okay, maybe you haven't done it, but so anyways, we'll just stop there. And he has her husband killed. And then when he finally comes to his senses, his prayer is recorded in Psalm 51. And he starts off and he says, Father, against you and you alone have I sinned. And I'm just picturing Uriah sitting up in heaven. If he can eavesdrop in on the prayers going, come again. Against him and him alone you've sinned? If I remember correctly, I had a good life and a good wife, and you kind of like took all that away from me and took my life. And now you're going to sit there and say, against you and you alone have I sinned? Could you mention my name at least somewhere in this prayer? But he never does. And I've always looked at them like, what gives? Because, you know, when I think about my sin, I think about my impact and the people I've hurt and the things I've done to people and how I've impacted my relationships with others. And so we always think oftentimes about me versus everybody else. And we miss this communal nature, this bigger picture about sin. And the best way I can explain it is this, is that in my household, I've got boys and I've got a girl. And when my son hits my daughter, oftentimes he'll look at me and he'll look at me and say, I'm sorry, Dad. Okay? And you say, why is he apologizing to me for hitting my daughter? And some of y'all think because he's about to get his butt whooped. That's not exactly correct. Maybe. Yeah, but I would like to think that there's a philosophical thought that goes through his mind. I would like to think, and I think that actually happens, even at 8 years old, I think there's enough of a picture in your mind of what exactly has just occurred. And he may not be able to completely verbalize what's going on, but I can tell you what's going on in there. That he knows that what he's just done by hitting his sister is a violation of the kind of home that I've worked very hard to create for us to live in. I've worked very hard to make our house, make our home, a place that is full of love and acceptance and security. Because when you're in our home, I want you to feel loved and I want you to feel secure. And if you come into our house and you get hit, you don't feel loved and you don't feel secure. And when you're the culprit, when you're the one who has ruined the kind of picture, the kind of home that I've wanted to create, and those kids know that's the way our home is. We don't hit. We don't call names. We love. We share. That's the kind of home that Daddy has worked really, really hard to create. And he knows in that moment he has violated the created order that I've set for our home. And it clicks. This is not how I should act, and I've messed everything up in the house. Daddy, I'm sorry. I know this isn't what you wanted. And so he says, I've sinned against heaven. Heaven is the environment that God intended for us to live in. And if you look at scripture, there's a parallel between how the Garden of Eden was in Genesis chapter 1 and how heaven is over in Revelation chapter 20. There's a parallel there. Both have the tree of life in them, and both is a place of love and security, and there's a place of rest. There's nothing to harm and nothing to hurt, and everything is perfect. But you know that the fall entered and sin entered, and in just a few short sentences after sin enters, Cain goes out and he kills Abel. And decision after decision is made, and we mess up the heaven that God intended and created for us to live in. And so when you realize that I have sinned, what you're saying is, God, I have sinned and I have messed up the creative order which you intended for us to live in. And you wanted everybody to have an opportunity to live in a place where they feel loved and they feel secure. And I've messed that up. And what I've done by my actions, I'm a part of the systemic evil and corruption that pervades everything around me. And it'd be very easy for me to watch the nightly news and say, I can't believe somebody would ever do that. But a moment of clarity, I realize I'm a part of it. And every time I make a selfish decision to worry about myself over against anybody else, I am messing up the created order that you intended us for to live in. I often say, I wish everywhere we went and everywhere we lived and everybody we talked to was exactly like it is for the 1 hour we spent in this building on a Sunday morning. And I know it's not perfect, but it's as close to perfect as we get. I mean, any one of you ladies could leave your purse in here and walk out there and go to the, use the restroom, go get some coffee, whatever. And you have no fear of somebody taking it. But you'd never do that in an airport. You'd never do it at the mall. Because when we come to church, we get this a little taste of the way the created order was supposed to be that God wanted us, for us to live in. We may not steal a purse, but we know that we have violated that created order, and we know we've messed that up. And so he says, I've sinned against heaven and what you created, what you intended. And God, I've sinned against you. And I've broken our relationship. And I didn't trust that what you wanted for me would be what was best for me. And I thought I knew better, and I thought I could outsmart this thing, and I thought maybe you were holding me back, and I thought you were holding out. And I didn't trust you enough to follow you. So God, I've sinned against you. And then he says, I am no longer worthy to be called your son. And it's as if he's saying, listen, I know what I've lost, and I've lost a father. But I also know I no longer am worthy to be called a son. And he's right. He's not. The things he's done and the way that he's lived, he is no longer worthy of being called a son. And so from that point, he says, he kind of comes up with a plan. He understands where he's at. He's come to his senses to see where I'm at and what I've done. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. That's the clarity and the vision that he has in that moment. He's finally thinking clear. And then he says, make me one of your hired servants. And everything in this speech is going along really good until right at this point is where he begins to go down a bad path. And it's the same path you and I go down. It's the same path all of humanity has gone down ever since we realized we messed up. Every time we get that moment of clarity, we immediately try to figure out, how is it that I can get back in God's graces? And so we come up with a plan to try to figure it out. And it doesn't matter if you go back to ancient times or modern times or even postmodern times. We've all messed this up. And you can go into Eastern philosophy. You can go into Western religion. You can go to any kind of thought you want to and see, how is it that people have tried to answer the question, how do you get back into God's graces? And every time we try to come up with an idea or a plan, it doesn't work. And that's usually what we call religion. Religions are all about us trying to come up with a plan to try to somehow, some way, be good enough for God to accept us once again. And so he says, God, he says, maybe I could just become one of your hired servants. And understand what he's saying here is, he's saying, I want to go back to my father. And in the father's household, there were basically three groups of people. I'll just kind of give you an overgeneralization of this. There was the family, so his sons. And the sons, they had full reign of everything. I mean, they didn't do a lot of work. They pretty much just oversaw the work. They were there. They were the heirs. And they had the run of the mill. And he looks, he says, well, I know I'm not worthy of being a son. I've lost that. I get that. I get that. Also in the father's household, there were the household servants. And that would be kind of like the equivalent, maybe if you think of like a butler or a maid or a nanny. And the household servants would be on permanent staff in the house. They would live in the house. They would eat there in the house. They wouldn't eat with the family, but they would be there and serve the meals. But then as soon as the meals were over, they'd either eat at the table or eat at the kitchen. They would be there in the house. They would sleep there in the house. They were a part of the household. They'd be cared for by the household. And they wouldn't necessarily get paid a wage so much as they would just always have their needs taken care of. They would never have a need. The needs would always be taken care of by the family, and they would just be there, and they'd be a part of it, and they would be given all kinds of wonderful benefits just for being a household servant. And then the next group of people were the hired servants. And those were people who would be, they'd live in town, and they'd be hired to come out and perform a service. It'd be like a plumber or a carpenter or a landscape guy. And they would come in, they'd do a service, they'd get paid a wage, and then they'd head back home. Some of them would work there every day. Some would be hired just in on a special occasion, maybe at harvest time. And so what he's saying is, I know I'm no longer worthy of being a son, and I don't have any right to even ask to be a household servant. Can you just make me one of your hired servants? I'll just come back in. I'll kind of live in the vicinity, and I'll come in and visit during the day. And if you could just pay me a wage, and here's where you just picture, you can see his mind thinking here. I need to make some money so I can earn enough to pay you back for what I've taken. Because earlier in the story, the part I didn't read to you this morning was that he went to his father and he says, give me my share of the inheritance. Give me all the money that I got coming to me when you die, because pretty much I'm done with you. As far as I'm concerned, you're dead. Just give me my portion of the inheritance. And he says he went out and he wasted all that money. He wasted half of everything the father had and he wasted it. And he realizes that. And so he thinks to himself, I got to pay him back, so I can earn my way back into his good graces. So if I could just be a hired servant, I'll just work the rest of my life in hopes of paying him back somehow, some way. And so that's his plan. Because what he's thinking is that I know my dad's going to be mad at me, and he's going to be ticked at me, but if I could just earn enough to get back, maybe somehow I could kind of get back to even or to okay or whatever. And so that's his plan. And it says, so he got up and he went. He went to his father. Verse 20, it says, but while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. And his father ran out to his son and he threw his arms around him and he kissed him. And the son said to him, so the son's, you know, there, he doesn't know what to think. And you can just picture he's been rehearsing this speech over and over and over again. And so he begins the speech. And he says, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. And you can see he's trying to get out the next words, because if you go back up and you read his speech was, Father, I've sinned against heaven and you, and I'm no longer worthy to be called your son. So make me one of your hired servants. So he's there with his dad. He's trying to get out this last piece. He's saying, you know, Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. So make me one of your, and as he's trying to get it out, he's interrupted by the father, who's just kissing him and hugging on him and squeezing him. And you can just picture, you know, a time like when you get squeezed so hard, like your face gets buried in the chest and you're trying to talk, but and then at this point, the father isn't talking to him, but the father's talking to everybody around him. He's like, you know, quit looking, quit staring, go get a robe. My son needs something to wear. Go get a robe, go get some sandals, put them on his feet, go put a ring back on his finger. My son who is lost, who I thought might be dead, is home. He's alive. We got to celebrate. We got to party. My son has come home. While he's trying to say, I'm no longer worthy to be called your son, his father's sitting there saying, you are my son, and I'm just so glad you're home. And don't miss one little piece. I'm going to get to this later on in this series. But he puts a ring on his finger. And that wasn't just a bunch of bling. What that was basically saying is, you're going to be able to carry out family business. You're going to be useful to me again. You're going to be trusted again. And sometimes we come back to God and we think to ourselves, you know, I can get that God could forgive me, but I could never be used by him to do anything. God would never trust me to use me in any way of any significance, because he knows I've already messed it up and I've already blown it. But here what you see in this picture is Jesus trying to give him the story. And he's like, this is what your heavenly father has done. And he doesn't hear the words that he thinks he's going to hear, such as, how dare you and how could you? He just gets love and he just gets grace. And that's the message of the gospel right here in a nutshell. Just in this one story, Jesus tells you the message of the gospel, that no matter what you've done, no matter what you've become, your heavenly father, you want to know what he's thinking about you right now? He's just thinking, I miss you. Just come home. I don't care. And that's hard to imagine, because if you're like me and you go think back in your relationship with your dad, I remember one night I was out and went down to, I don't even remember what the occasion was. We went down to Fort Lauderdale. It's about a half hour, 45 minutes. It was about an hour away from where I lived. It'd be like driving up to Williamsburg for the night with some friends. A little further away than where I was supposed to be going when I was in 10th grade. I remember now. Anybody know why you'd make a dumb decision like that when you're in 10th grade? Yeah, how'd you know? Yeah, there was a girl. Who was down there. And so we had the idea, we'll go down and see her. And you get down there and you're hanging out. You know how it is. It just, time gets away from you. Then you look at the clock and you realize, oh, stink. Curfew's in 10 minutes and I'm an hour away from home. And you start doing the math. You're thinking about, I know what happens when I'm 10 minutes late for curfew. I know what happens when I'm a half hour late for curfew. I don't even want to think about what's going to happen if I'm an hour late for curfew. And the fear strikes you so severely, you just decide not to come home. You're either laughing at me or you're remembering a time in your own life where you've done the same thing. And I'm assuming it's the latter. And so somewhere around the time that the sun came up, I finally realized I didn't have anywhere else to go, you know? I mean, if I go to my friend's house, I mean, the call is going to be made eventually, you know. And I remember coming home. And I remember my dad opens the door. And he just gives me a big hug and he just says, I'm glad you're safe. I'm glad you're okay. I'm glad you're home. And I went upstairs and laid down and fell asleep. There was more to that story. My father was not God, and I wasn't at a good place with Jesus, but we won't get into that. We'll just talk about that part of the story. And so the Father invites him back in, and you might think, you know, I know what happened in your story because that's reality, but this isn't reality. There's a consequence here. You know, it just can't be that easy. I mean, you couldn't even come up with an illustration that talked about something this easy. But you know, what you got to remember in this story is the focus of the story isn't the people Jesus is talking to. It isn't the worst of the worst people that are listening. It isn't the best of the best of the people who are listening to, like people who have got it all figured out. The focus of the story isn't the prodigal son who's gone away and squandered everything and gets to come back home. That's not really the main person in the story. And there's an older brother in this story. We haven't even gotten into him. We'll get into him later on in the series. And he's not the main part of the story. And believe it or not, the father isn't even actually the main character in this story. And I've heard this story taught every different which way, where every different person in this story is made out to be. This is what the real story is really about. But the main person in this story is the one who's telling it. It's Jesus. It's Jesus. And you see, this is God, a very God, who's come down on earth to tell you and me what to expect when we come home. And he says, this is what you can expect from your Heavenly Father when you come home. And I know it. And you're thinking, but there's got to be a cost. I know when you woke up the next day, there was a consequence, wasn't there? Yes. So how is this story any different? I'll tell you how this story is any different. Because the guy who's telling this story has already resolutely set his gaze upon Jerusalem. And he's telling this story while he knows he's on the way to a cross. And he's going to be beaten, and he's going to suffer. He's going to be crucified on a cross. And he is going to get everything that you think that you deserve if you come home. I mentioned earlier that every time that Jesus would address God, he calls him Father. Every time but one. And it's recorded in Matthew 27. And when it's when he's on the cross, he cries out in that moment. He doesn't say Father. He says, my God, why have you forsaken me? I'll tell you why. It's because of you and it's because of me. He got everything that we think that we're going to get when we come home. And in that moment, he wasn't welcomed in as a son. He was distant. He was estranged. And he was getting everything that we think that we deserve when we try to come into God's presence. And in that moment, God turned his back on him and did not welcome him in, so that you and I could be. So when Jesus tells this story about a prodigal son who makes his way home and his father comes out to meet him and rush to greet him, and you're thinking, but there's a consequence here. What he would go on to teach and to show and to tell everybody else who would hear this story for generations to come is the reason why you and I can come home. It's because he gave us everything that he earned so we wouldn't get what we deserved and we could come home. And all we need to do is just come to God and say, God, I have sinned against heaven, against earth, and I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But because of what your son Jesus Christ did in his life and on the cross to pay the penalty for me and my sins, what we celebrate on Easter is the reason why I can come home. And every Sunday of the year, we end our service with communion, where we focus on that death and that price that Jesus Christ paid for us. Every Sunday but this one. Because we had a Passover service on Thursday night where we celebrated that and focused on that. And this is the day, though, that we celebrate the resurrection. This is where we celebrate the opportunity that we have to come home. The fact that he has paid for everything and rolled out the red carpet for us to come in. And so on Easter Sunday, usually we just kind of end the message and I show you just some video that kind of wraps everything up and just kind of explains and try to give you just some time to reflect on the message of Easter and what it means for you and how it impacts you. And I got to tell you, this is the first year. I mean, if you guys have been around for any length of time, you know I never have a shortage of clips to show. I mean, there's always something different, unique. Last week we showed you ShamWow with Vince Schmuley. Weeks before. I mean, there's always something out there. You just never know what you're going to get. But I got to tell you, I had a really, really, really hard time this week because I hate most stuff that you find in the Christian, like, genre of video, okay? That's why you almost never see me show a Christian movie, video, anything, right? I mean, when was the last time you can even think of me showing some, like, Christian media thing? It's always something else. Because everything in a Christian circle, usually it's poorly filmed, poorly done, bad acting, and worst of all, it is just plain cheesy, right? It is. It just. I mean, you're just like, really? Really, that's how it's going to turn out? It's every Christian piece of media always turns out like an 80s movie, right? You know, the dork, the nerd, the guy who nobody likes at the end of the movie. You know, he does something heroic, and everybody who hated him early in the movie kind of stands up, and they do the slow clap. You know, and the whole high school cheers the dork, which you know never happens. And so you watch those old 80s movies, you know, and you're just like, and you kind of laugh. You're like, oh, this never happens. And so when it comes to trying to find you a clip of the prodigal son, every single one I looked at, I just kept going, this is so cheesy. I mean, it just doesn't happen. I mean, every one of them. Just, and you know why something seems cheesy to you? Because it doesn't seem real. You look at that and you go, that's so fake. It doesn't happen like that. No, nobody at Ocean Lakes, Kellum, Salem, and nobody is going to be standing up and cheering the dork in school when he punches the bully in the face. No, they're going to get out their phones and watch the bully get up and go to town on him, right? That's what they're going to be doing. That's how it works out in real life. And so we watch a movie that tries to make you think that this is how it's going to turn out. We go, this is so cheesy. I'm not even watching this. This is just stupid. But here's what hit me this week. In the midst of looking at this going, this is just so cheesy. But it's real. And this story seems too good to be true, but Jesus is saying this is real. And so as you watch this video and you reflect on it, right when you get to the point where you start thinking this is cheesy, let it come back and hit you right between the eyes that this is real. And this is the one time in all of history where that which seems too good to be true and that which you can't even believe is real. And that's Easter. And that's what we celebrate today. And that's what this Sunday is all about. It's a story and a message that is too good to be true. So after we close in prayer, I just want to encourage you to watch it and hear the message from your Heavenly Father to come on home.